Chapter 6. Pulpit stairs on Sunday evening, he was obliged to hold on by the rails, or he would certainly have fallen over into his own pew. Mr. Sliverstone, who has been listening and smiling meekly, says, "Not quite so bad as that, not quite so bad." ... He admits, though, on cross-examination, that he was very near falling upon the verger who was following him up to bolt the door, but adds that it was his duty as a Christian to fall upon him, if need were, and that he, Mr. Sliverstone, and possibly the verger too, ought to glory in it. This sentiment communicates new impulse to Mrs. Sliverstone, who launches into new praises of Mr. Sliverstone's worth and excellence, to which he listens in the same meek silence, save when he puts in a word of self-denial relative to some question of fact, as "Not 72 christenings that week, my dear. Only 71, only 71. ... At length his lady has quite concluded, and then he says, "Why should he repine? Why should he give way? Why should he suffer his heart to sink within him? Is it he alone who toils and suffers? What has she gone through, he should like to know? What does she go through every day for him and for society?" With such an exordium, Mr. Sliverstone launches out into glowing praises of the conduct of Mrs. Sliverstone in the production of 8 young children, and the subsequent rearing and fostering of the same, and thus the husband magnifies the wife, and the wife the husband. This would be well enough, if Mr. and Mrs. Sliverstone kept it to themselves, or even to themselves and a friend or two, but they do not. The more ears they have, the more egotistical the couple become, and the more anxious they are to make believers in their merits. Perhaps this is the worst kind of egotism. It is not even the poor excuse of being spontaneous, but is the result of a deliberate system and malice aforethought. Mere empty-headed conceit excites our pity, but ostentatious hypocrisy awakens our disgust. The couple who coddle themselves. Mrs. Merrywinkle's maiden name was Chopper. She was the only child of Mr. and Mrs. Chopper. Her father died when she was, as the playbooks express it, yet an infant. ... And so old Mrs. Chopper, when her daughter married, made the house of her son-in-law her home from that time henceforth, and set up her staff of rest with Mr. and Mrs. Merrywinkle. Mr. and Mrs. Merrywinkle are a couple who coddle themselves, and the venerable Mrs. Chopper is an aider and abettor in the same. Mr. Merrywinkle is a rather lean and long-necked gentleman, middle-aged and middle-sized, and usually troubled with a cold in the head. Mrs. Merrywinkle is a delicate-looking lady, with very light hair, and is exceedingly subject to the same unpleasant disorder. The venerable Mrs. Chopper, who is strictly entitled to the appellation, her daughter not being very young, otherwise than by courtesy, at the time of her marriage, which was some years ago, is a mysterious old lady who lurks behind a pair of spectacles, and is afflicted with a chronic disease, respecting which she has taken a vast deal of medical advice, and referred to a vast number of medical books, without meeting any definition of symptoms that at all suits her, or enables her to say, "That's my complaint." ... Indeed, the absence of authentic information upon the subject of this complaint would seem to be Mrs. Chopper's greatest ill, as in all other respects she is an uncommonly hale and hearty gentlewoman. Both Mr. and Mrs. Chopper wear an extraordinary quantity of flannel, and have a habit of putting their feet in hot water to an unnatural extent. They likewise indulge in chamomile tea and such like compounds, and rub themselves on the slightest provocation with camphorated spirits, and other lotions applicable to mumps, sore throat, rheumatism, or lumbago. Mr. Merrywinkle's leaving home to go to business on a damp or wet morning is a very elaborate affair. He puts on wash leather socks over his stockings, and India rubber shoes above his boots, and wears under his waistcoat a cuirass of hare skin. Besides these precautions, He winds a thick shawl round his throat and blocks up his mouth with a large silk handkerchief. Thus accoutred and furnished besides with a greatcoat and umbrella, he braves the dangers of the streets, traveling in severe weather at a gentle trot, the better to preserve the circulation, and bringing his mouth to the surface to take breath, but very seldom, and with the utmost caution. His office door opened, he shoots past his clerk at the same pace, and diving into his own private room, closes the door, examines the window fastenings, and gradually unrobes himself. Hanging his pocket handkerchief on the fender to air, and determining to write to the newspapers about the fog, which, he says, has really got to that pitch that it is quite unbearable. Apostrophe, in this last opinion Mrs. Merewinkle and her respected mother fully concur, for though not present, their thoughts and tongues are occupied with the same subject, which is their constant theme all day. If anybody happens to call, Mrs. Merewinkle opines that they must assuredly be mad, and her first salutation is, "Why, what in the name of goodness can bring you out in such weather? You know you must catch your death." Apostrophe This assurance is corroborated by Mrs. Chopper, who adds, in further confirmation, a dismal legend concerning an individual of her acquaintance who, making a call under precisely parallel circumstances, and being then in the best health and spirits, expired in 48 hours afterwards, of a complication of inflammatory disorders. The visitor, rendered not altogether comfortable perhaps by this and other precedents, inquires very affectionately after Mr. Merewinkle, but by so doing brings about no change of the subject, for Mr. Merewinkle's name is inseparably connected with his complaints, and his complaints are inseparably connected with Mrs. Merewinkle's, and when these are done with, Mrs. Chopper, who has been biding her time, cuts in with the chronic disorder, a subject upon which the amiable old lady never leaves off speaking until she is left alone, and very often not then. But Mr. Merewinkle comes home to dinner. He is received by Mrs. Merewinkle and Mrs. Chopper, who, on his remarking that he thinks his feet are damp, turn pale as ashes, and drag him upstairs, imploring him to have them rubbed directly with a dry coarse towel. Rubbed they are, one by Mrs. Merewinkle and one by Mrs. Chopper, until the friction causes Mr. Merewinkle to make horrible faces, and look as if he had been smelling very powerful onions. When they desist, and the patient, provided for his better security with thick worsted stockings and list slippers, is borne downstairs to dinner. Now, the dinner is always a good one, the appetites of the diners being delicate, and requiring a little of what Mrs. Merewinkle calls titivation, apostrophe the secret of which is understood to lie in good cookery and tasteful spices, and which process is so successfully performed in the present instance, that both Mr. and Mrs. Merewinkle eat a remarkably good dinner, and even the afflicted Mrs. Chopper wields her knife and fork with much of the spirit and elasticity of youth. But Mr. Merewinkle, in his desire to gratify his appetite, is not unmindful of his health, for he has a bottle of carbonate of soda with which to qualify his porter, and a little pair of scales in which to weigh it out. Neither in his anxiety to take care of his body is he unmindful of the welfare of his immortal part, as he always prays that for what he is going to receive he may be made truly thankful, and in order that he may be as thankful as possible, eats and drinks to the utmost. Either from eating and drinking so much, or from being the victim of this constitutional infirmity, among others, Mr. Merewinkle, after two or three glasses of wine, falls fast asleep, and he has scarcely closed his eyes, when Mrs. Merewinkle and Mrs. Chopper fall asleep likewise. It is on awakening at tea time that their most alarming symptoms prevail, for then Mr. Merewinkle feels as if his temples were tightly bound round with the chain of the street door, and Mrs. Merewinkle, as if she had made a hearty dinner of half hundredweights, and Mrs. Chopper, as if cold water were running down her back, and oyster knives with sharp points were plunging of their own accord into her ribs. Symptoms like these are enough to make people peevish, and no wonder that they remain so until supper time, doing little more than doze and complain, unless Mr. Merrywinkle calls out very loudly to a servant to keep that draught out. Apostrophe rushes into the passage to flourish his fist in the countenance of the twopenny postman for daring to give such a knock as he had just performed at the door of a private gentleman with nerves. Supper, coming after dinner, should consist of some gentle provocative, and therefore the titivating art is again in requisition, and again done honor to by Mr. and Mrs. Merrywinkle, still comforted and abetted by Mrs. Chopper. After supper, it is 10 to 1, but the last-named old lady becomes worse, and is led off to bed with the chronic complaint in full vigor. Mr. and Mrs. Merrywinkle, having administered to her a warm cordial, which is something of the strongest, then repair to their own room, where Mr. Merrywinkle, with his legs and feet in hot water, superintends the mulling of some wine which he is to drink at the very moment he plunges into bed, while Mrs. Merrywinkle, in garments whose nature is unknown to, and unimagined by all but married men, takes 4 small pills with a spasmodic look between each, and finally comes to something hot and fragrant out of another little saucepan, which serves as her composing draught for the night. There is another kind of couple who coddle themselves, and who do so at a cheaper rate, and on more spare diet, because they are niggardly and parsimonious, for which reason they are kind enough to coddle their visitors to. It is unnecessary to describe them, for our readers may rest assured of the accuracy of these general principles. That all couples who coddle themselves are selfish and slothful, that they charge upon every wind that blows, every rain that falls, and every vapor that hangs in the air, the evils which arise from their own imprudence, or the gloom which is engendered in their own tempers, and that all men and women, in couples or otherwise, who fall into exclusive habits of self-indulgence, and forget their natural sympathy and close connection with everybody and everything in the world around them, not only neglect the first duty of life, but, by a happier attributive justice, deprive themselves of its truest and best enjoyment. The old couple, they are grandfather and grandmother to a dozen grown people, and have great-grandchildren besides. Their bodies are bent, their hair is gray, their step tottering and infirm. Is this the lightsome pair whose wedding was so merry, and have the young couple indeed grown old so soon? It seems but yesterday, and yet what a host of cares and griefs are crowded into the intervening time which, reckoned by them, lengthens out into a century. How many new associations have wreathed themselves about their hearts since then? The old time is gone, and a new time has come for others, not for them. They are but the rusting link that feebly joins the two, and is silently loosening its hold and dropping asunder. It seems but yesterday, and yet 3 of their children have sunk into the grave, and the tree that shades it has grown quite old. One was an infant, they wept for him. The next a girl, a slight young thing too delicate for earth, her loss was hard indeed to bear. The third, a man. That was the worst of all, but even that grief is softened now. It seems but yesterday, and yet how the gay and laughing faces of that bright morning have changed and vanished from above ground. Faint likenesses of some remain about them yet, but they are very faint, and scarcely to be traced. The rest are only seen in dreams, and even they are unlike what they were, in eyes so old and dim. 1 or 2 dresses from the bridal wardrobe are yet preserved. They are of a quaint and antique fashion, and seldom seen except in pictures. White has turned yellow, and brighter hues have faded. Do you wonder, child? The wrinkled face was once as smooth as yours, the eyes as bright, the shriveled skin as fair and delicate. It is the work of hands that have been dust these many years. Where are the fairy lovers of that happy day whose annual return comes upon the old man and his wife, like the echo of some village bell which has long been silent? Let yonder peevish bachelor, racked by rheumatic pains, and quarreling with the world, let him answer to the question. He recollects something of a favorite playmate. Her name was Lucy, so they tell him. He is not sure whether she was married, or went abroad, or died. It is a long while ago, and he don't remember. Is nothing as it used to be. Does no one feel, or think, or act, as in days of yore? Yes. There is an aged woman who once lived servant with the old lady's father, and is sheltered in an almshouse not far off. She is still attached to the family, and loves them all. She nursed the children in her lap, and tended in their sickness those who are no more. Her old mistress has still something of youth in her eyes. The young ladies are like what she was, but not quite so handsome, nor are the gentlemen as stately as Mr. Harvey used to be. She has seen a great deal of trouble. Her husband and her son died long ago, but she has got over that, and is happy now, quite happy. If ever her attachment to her old protectors were disturbed by fresher cares and hopes, it has long since resumed its former current. It has filled the void in the poor creature's heart, and replaced the love of kindred. Death has not left her alone, and this, with a roof above her head, and a warm hearth to sit by, makes her cheerful and contented. Does she remember the marriage of great-grandmama? Eh, that she does, as well as if it was only yesterday. You wouldn't think it to look at her now, and perhaps she ought not to say so of herself, but she was as smart a young girl then as you'd wish to see. She recollects she took a friend of hers upstairs to see Miss Emma dressed for church. Her name was she forgets the name, but she remembers that she was a very pretty girl, and that she married not long afterwards, and lived it as quite passed out of her mind where she lived. But she knows she had a bad husband who used her ill, and that she died in Lambeth Workhouse. Dear, dear, in Lambeth Workhouse. And the old couple, have they no comfort or enjoyment of existence? See them among their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. How garrulous they are, how they compare one with another, and insist on likenesses which no one else can see. How gently the old lady lectures the girls on points of breeding and decorum, and points the moral by anecdotes of herself in her young days. How the old gentleman chuckles over boyish feats and roguish tricks, and tells long stories of a barring out achieved at the school he went to, which was very wrong, he tells the boys, and never to be imitated of course, but which he cannot help letting them know, was very pleasant too, especially when he kissed the master's niece. This last, however, is a point on which the old lady is very tender, for she considers it a shocking and indelicate thing to talk about, and always says so whenever it is mentioned, never failing to observe that he ought to be very penitent for having been so sinful. So the old gentleman gets no further, and what the schoolmaster's niece said afterwards, which he is always going to tell, is lost to posterity. The old gentleman is 80 years old, today 80 years old, coughs, and never had a headache, apostrophe he tells the barber who shaves him, the barber being a young fellow, and very subject to that complaint, that's a great age, coughs, apostrophe says the old gentleman. I don't think it's such a worry great age, sir, apostrophe replied the barber. Crofts, apostrophe rejoins the old gentleman, you're talking nonsense to me. 80 not a great age? Apostrophe it's a worry great age, sir, for a gentleman to be as healthy and active as you are, apostrophe returns the barber. But my grandfather, sir, he was 94. Apostrophe you don't mean that, Crofts? Apostrophe says the old gentleman. I do. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.